Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on August 14, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Pamadavaharan Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches the importance of developing and dwelling in refined mindfulness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So this sutta, the Pamadavaharan Sutta, is a sutta on developing restraint in this sutta in relation to refined mindfulness that's developed through the Eightfold Path. And this restraint is an underlying theme in all of the Buddha's Dhamma, and it's the one thing I think that people have the biggest difficulty with. A self-referential ego personality that is ignorant, lacking understanding of the true nature of human life, is always grasping after things to keep itself satisfied and to keep itself distracted. The Buddha taught that the first noble truth is that dukkha occurs. He could have nearly as accurately said distraction occurs, because it is the preoccupation with dukkha, with keeping ourselves happy, avoiding anything that might affect our happiness or our safety or our status or our power or our pocketbook, that keeps driving us out of our bodies and out of the present moment, which is really the same thing. The entire Buddha's Dhamma is about uniting our mind and our body and keeping it there. And a lack of restraint always takes us out of our body. It takes us into the past or into the future. It takes us out of what's occurring. And it's always rooted in what the Buddha taught is the initial cause of suffering rooted in ignorance, which is craving. So obviously restraint is the antidote to craving, isn't it? And there's a series of talks that I'll be giving now. Tonight is one of them. Thursday's talk is on another sutta that relates to restraint. Saturday's talk here will be on restraint, and probably next Tuesday's talk will be on restraint, but in a slightly different way that the Buddha addresses this very important topic. The Buddha's words, friends, pay close attention. I will teach you about one who dwells in mindlessness and one who dwells in mindfulness. And how does one dwell in mindlessness? When one is unrestrained at the eye, the mind is agitated and distracted by mental fabrications. When agitated and distracted, there is no joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Lacking joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment. There is only disappointment and distraction. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. Now that reference to mental fabrications relates directly to what the Buddha awakened to, dependent origination, which states that from ignorance, as a requisite condition, comes mental fabrications. So you can see how this sutta, as in all the Buddha's sutta, or most of them anyway, get right to the heart of the matter of addressing ignorance of the way things truly are. And so the Buddha's Dhamma is about developing very specific insight into the impermanent nature of all things, the not-self characteristic, meaning that we're seeing ourselves in relation to the world from wrong views, which results in the third mark of existence, ongoing suffering. You can put that all into a basket and call it mindlessness, because that's what it is. We don't have control of our minds, and so we're constantly distracted by the nature of dukkha in the world. We don't understand it. When the Buddha describes an awakened human being from the point of view of right view, he says that person understands at a profound level, at a pervasive level, suffering. That mind understands its own contributions to suffering to itself and to the world at large. The Buddha continues, when one dwells unrestrained over the ear or the nose or the tongue or the body, the mind is agitated and distracted. There is no joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Lacking joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. So again, the Buddha is stating very clearly that you either develop the Dhamma or you wander around, the word that's often used is samsara, you wander around mindlessly in samsara. You might live a life, you might live a very successful life. It might even seem fulfilling at times. But it's lacking an understanding of the true nature of life. So it's a mindless life, isn't it? If we want to develop a life that is rooted in mindfulness, that can experience each moment as it's supposed to be in a skillful way, we develop mindfulness. Is that clear? The point I'm trying to make is, again, there's nothing magical or mystical about what the Buddha is teaching. There's nothing here that is taught to have us escape from reality. It's about immersing ourselves in reality, unrestrained by mindlessness, by developing full mindfulness, or refined mindfulness. Is that clear? It's an important point. If we really want to have a completely meaningful life, moment by moment by moment, we'll develop the Dhamma. And that's really the choice we have, isn't it? There's all kinds of things we can do as spiritual or religious practices, or even wholesome hobbies. And they're all, most of them are wonderful things to do to occupy our time. But nothing fulfills like the Buddha's Dhamma. Frank.
How do you study the Dhamma, integrate it into your life when you only get to the Sangha once a week?
Oh, well, I'm going to start a seven-night class. So you got to start driving a lot. Well, I'm sorry to be so flippant, because that really is an important question. We are really fortunate to have what we have here in Frenchtown, a well-focused Sangha. But nobody can be part of a well-focused Sangha 24/7 unless I decide to find a lot of funding and start a monastery and we all go there. That's not likely to happen. The answer is in the Eightfold Path, and two factors of the Eightfold Path point us in that right direction: right intention and right effort. Right intention is the ongoing being mindful of the ongoing intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. This sutta and all the suttas that speak to restraint speak to that. And then right effort is a reminder of where we should place our thoughts within the framework of the Eightfold Path. So even though most of us can only be part of a Sangha once a week, maybe twice a week, if you're lucky, three times a week, but outside of that, the Buddha gave us a framework for how to stay in that, and that is the Eightfold Path. It's rooted in meditation, but then there's also a study part, and there's a practical application part of the Eightfold Path. In other words, as we start to integrate the Eightfold Path and we find ourselves seeing the world in a way that's agitating to us, we can recognize that it's agitating because I'm not seeing it clearly. I'm in wrong view. How do we develop right view? That's, again, a reminder to come back to the Eightfold Path. If we find ourselves in arguments with people, or maybe just an argument in our own mind against what's occurring in the world, we can remind ourselves, well, that's an aspect of wrong speech and probably wrong action too, and come back into the skillful applications of the Eightfold Path. So it takes time to integrate that. The Sangha is meant to be an ongoing support for Dhamma practice. In fact, I would say an essential ongoing support. The Buddha, we talked about that in the Upada Sutta a few weeks ago. For nearly every human being, the goal cannot be accomplished without a well-focused Sangha. This is something the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago. It's something that I've had direct experience with over the last 30-some-odd years. So the answer to your question is, how do you do it? With concerted right effort, Frank. Does that help?
I guess my situation is that I meditate twice a day, probably. I devote about an hour to retreat to a cushion to meditate so I can engage in my daily life. I read your book. I read the Dhamma studies. I'm mindful as much as I can all day about the Eightfold Path and where I'm at, and I try to practice restraint. But I live a life that is consumed by other people in my family. I'm in a family business. My whole entire day is all people, all day. So when I have a difficult day, it doesn't matter how much I'm meditating or practicing or knowing or how aware or mindful I am of everything. There's some sleepless nights. I mean, there's some nights where I wake up and I'm like so aware of what's the saying that Buddhists is everyone's on fire, their hair's on fire or whatever.
The world is on fire.
I mean, it's just so crazy. I'm laying there in bed at 12:30 saying, this world is insane. Like, and I'm a part of it. And it's frightening, actually. It's like, what do I do? Because I'm completely powerless over everyone else. I have no control over nothing except my own behavior. And all I can do is just be here to help clean up the mess.
The subtle answer is the first noble truth. Dukkha occurs. As a consequence of living in the world, there's going to be disappointing, unsatisfactory experiences. There's going to be stress. Another word for dukkha is stress. And that's what you're describing. The best that we can do is to do just what you're doing. Now, I know you, so I know the answer to this question, but looking back at the quality of your mind 3 years ago, comparing it to today, you've developed quite a deep level of calm and peace, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
And that calm and peace is directly associated with the great level of disentanglement you've been able to create in your life, even while you have to be immersed in it, I would bet 18 hours a day at least. And
When I first did it, I did it to detangle myself from it. Yep. Now that I'm untangled from it, now it's almost, I feel that space, but now I'm re-engaging with it and trying to help people in my family and employees and just people who I live my life with find a better way.
And so in that way, you're carrying peace with you. I don't want to say it's impossible to be in a situation like you're in, and because it's not, but it nearly is to be that engaged in the world and to maintain what you would hope would be a certain quality of mind. But that's not what we're after. You are able to maintain your level of mindful restraint in many, many, I would say most situations, even though in the moment your mind might be becoming agitated. That's simply being a part of the world. It's not, when I say often to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states, would you say you're able to do that?
Yeah.
That's the key to the Dhamma. It doesn't mean that we're not involved in the chaos of the world, but the chaos of the world doesn't affect us at least as nearly as much as it used to, but we still might have sleepless nights. The immediate answer to that is not possible for most of us. The immediate answer, leave all that behind. The Buddha left the palace seeking understanding and peace, and upon his awakening, he didn't decide to go back into that life. He called that life, the worldly life, a confining place. But he was also able to stay out of it because of his position. Most of us aren't in that position where we can just leave our whole lives behind and live as a monk or a nun.
It's looking pretty tempting.
Well, but to qualify that answer, and there is nothing wrong if you as an individual decide that you want to spend the rest of your life disentangled from the world physically as well as mentally. There's nothing wrong with that. There's still people today that criticize the Buddha because he left his wife and newborn child, walked away from him to seek understanding. For one thing, that was an accepted practice during the Buddha's time. Most men of that age at least left their, they went from home to homelessness at least for a few years. But the Buddha did it for the most compassionate reasons, to find understanding for everyone. And he understood that he couldn't do it in that situation. And by the way, just to complete that little part of the story, Rahula became a senior monk in Awakened, and the woman that would take over Rahula's upbringing also joined the Sangha in Awakened too. So it's not like we completely leave the world behind, but to look at it in the way that you're doing it, you are bringing the Dhamma to those people in your family and around you as best you can, without standing on a street corner and saying you got to be a Buddhist. I would say you're doing the best you can, Frank. And the only thing we're left with is to continue to practice. It's not a silver bullet, but as you just described, it took you from a mind of constant distraction and agitation to a relatively peaceful and calm mind. Right? I'm not mischaracterizing that.
Yeah, no, it's pretty correct.
Yeah. So again, the answer for, and it is the same answer for all of us, is to continue with our right effort and continue to deepen our own understanding of the nature of the world. And the last thing I'll say about this before I get to Ram is it's very important to understand that dukkha occurs applies to everyone around us. And that we can't expect it to change. In other words, we gain an understanding of the way other people are acting because we understand that they're acting out of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Again, I'm not calling everyone on the planet ignorant, but they don't understand the nature of life. So they react to it and are always seeking distraction in one way or another. And us as awakened or awakening human beings can find it very challenging at times to be with people that aren't doing that. But that's where compassion and understanding comes in, doesn't it? We're very fortunate that, for one thing, that we found the Dhamma, that you found an incredibly brilliant teacher. That, again, I am joking. I'll give myself some credit for teaching the Dhamma as authentic as I can. That's as far as I'll go with it. But that we have been able to develop, not because, if it wasn't for Matt, none of us would be here tonight, but we've been able to develop a well-focused Sangha. This is something that is rare and unique in the world. And we have it to support our Dhamma practice. So, you know, maybe this is a half full kind of thing, glass half full. We're all doing pretty good, you know, to have this and to develop it as we have. I mean, and I know each and every one of you, and I know other members of our Sangha, especially the regulars, that have made incredible understandings of their own self in relation to the world around them and made huge changes. Would everyone say that they've developed a measure of peace and calm that wasn't here before they started Dhamma practice?
Yes.
Is there anyone that wouldn't say, and it's okay if you have to leave, but isn't that remarkable that we can say that honestly?
Yeah.
I mean, it's to me, it's, and I've been around this game a long time, it's almost stunning to be able to sit in there, and I could ask this of almost every class, and you know, the other people that aren't here tonight that might be here on Tuesday or Thursday, and they would all say the same thing. That's remarkable. That's where, you know, if not that I need it, but that's where my enthusiasm to keep doing this comes from, because of all of you. You know, and then to see someone like Frank, I remember Frank when we first talked on the phone, and it's remarkable the changes that he's made because of his own efforts. And also because of the still extant Dhamma, a 2,600-year-old teaching. It's amazing, isn't it? Long.
I just had a small thing. You mentioned Dhamma study as part of the Eightfold Path. Where does that, in which one of the factors of the Eightfold Path did that come in?
Well, it's an aspect of right effort. You know, when the Buddha describes right effort, one of the ways that he talks about right effort is to develop an understanding and integration of the Eightfold Path. So, and that sixth factor of the Eightfold Path is what kind of keeps us focused. But then what this talks about, joyful engagement, mudita is the Pali word. It does help to have some joyful engagement with what we're doing, to realize the benefits that it has for us and those around us. that helps generate joy in us, doesn't it? And that joyful engagement keeps us going at times when we feel like it's not working, when we might be laying in bed at night thinking about the world is on fire. And what can we do? The world is on fire, isn't it? Just like the Buddha, it's not any worse than it was when the Buddha described, but it's not much better in 2,600 years. What can we do? What did the Buddha do? What an awakened human being did? He did everything he could to maintain his level of concentration and refined mindfulness, because he knew that was the most compassionate thing he could do for himself and everyone else around him. And then think about the impact that the Buddha had during his time on the social and political climate. He literally changed the world. And I know I talk about it often. I think I talked about it Saturday too, it came up. 250 years, 300 years after the Buddha's death was King Ashoka, who was the most bloodthirsty leader this world has ever known, worse than any of the ones that we had in modern times. He came across the Dhamma, studied it, developed it, integrated it, and awakened. And he never harmed another soul. In fact, he started the first aspect of universal health care 2,300 years ago, something we still haven't figured out today. He went so far as to start universal veterinarian care for animals. That's how much he changed from coming to the Dhamma. And so the most loving thing we can do for ourselves and for the entire planet is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. And I would say that Frank is such a good example. We all are, but I'll use Frank as an example of how his interaction now with his family is bringing them a measure of peace and calm that they're able to implement into their own lives. That's remarkable. Now, whether they're not practicing the Dhamma, I know your daughter and your son have come here in Dawn, but they're not actively developing a Dhamma, but they're feeling the benefits of it. It's remarkable. Let me continue. If I remember where I was. The Buddha continues, when one dwells unrestrained of thoughts, the mind is agitated and distracted by ideological fabrications. Think about all the trouble in the world, and I don't mean to simplify the troubles that we have, but every one of them is rooted in protecting or promoting an ideological point of view, every single one of them. And I'm not talking about just one side of the political spectrum or the other. It's ideologies that are coming into conflict today, isn't it? And it's people insisting, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that their ideology is the only right one. And everybody else has to change to that one. The Buddha recognized that 2,600 years ago and taught about the dangers of it. There is no joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Lacking joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. He concludes that section with saying, this is how one dwells in mindlessness. So if you're ever concerned or wondering about if you're acting mindlessly or mindfully, read the sutta, because it tells you right there. The Buddha never leaves us there, though, in a suffering or confining place. He continues, and how does one dwell in mindfulness? When a Dhamma practitioner dwells in restraint with the eye, with the nose, with the ear, with the tongue, and with the body, the mind is not agitated or distracted by mental fabrications. You know, we've talked about this often. It is through we are psychophysical beings. And so it is through our physical senses that we come in contact with others and with the world. It just makes sense, doesn't it? So it's at that point of contact that we integrate the Dhamma. The Buddha often refers to the different sense organs as having their own consciousness. The eye has a consciousness, the nose has a consciousness, etc. And so as something comes in contact with my eye, that eye contact is interpreting and perceiving what has come in contact with the eye. And if it's interpreting or perceiving what is coming in contact with the eye or any of the other senses, if that eye consciousness is rooted in ignorance of the way things are, the interpretation and the perception is rooted in ignorance, isn't it? And it can only lead at some point, whether it's immediate or down the road, it can only lead to conflict and chaos. And the same thing with all of the other sense organ consciousnesses. And so the solution is to change that consciousness. Develop right thinking in relation to eye consciousness, ear consciousness, eye consciousness. So when the world comes in contact with us, we are seeing it clearly through right view. We have an underlying compassion because it's not clouded by how we want something or someone else to be. Our minds are resting in peace and equanimity no matter what's occurring. And so even if something arises that develops an impermanent, temporary, less than peaceful mind state, we understand and we are able to maintain a mind of equanimity, a mind of peace. We're able to maintain a less than a peaceful mind state in a less than peaceful situation. This is what the Buddha's teaching about. But he's teaching us how to do that in an impermanent world, a world that is constantly subject to change in a permanent manner, by simply changing the way that we think, by going from mindlessness to mindfulness, by understanding the process that distraction and agitation occurs. Where does it occur? At the point of contact with the world, right here. This is where we apply. This is where we apply mindfulness at our senses. And we learn to see things and perceive things and feel things and evaluate things from right view rather than wrong view. Let me continue.
John?
Yes?
There's also fabrications going on in your mind all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the five physical senses. I mean, you're carrying fabrications around all the time.
You bring up, and that leads to the sixth sense. Consciousness. When the Buddha talks about the, it mentioned later in the sutta, but thank you for bringing it up. We understand that what the Buddha references this as the sixth sense base, our five physical senses, and that sixth sense, which it is, of consciousness. Now we always qualify this. It's not consciousness with a big C. It's not some grand cosmic consciousness that unites us all into one grand cosmic being. It's simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so when you see those, the sixth sense base as it truly is in an unawakened human being, all six senses are contributing to further ignorance unless there's something that is integrated to recognize and abandon ignorance. That's why the Buddha gave us an Eightfold Path. He realized upon his awakening that there needed to be a method to pierce the veil of ignorance. And the common practice is one thing if I can call it this, a great understanding that I've learned, probably that I probably wouldn't have gotten if I wasn't sitting in this chair, in this cushion, is the powerful and subtle strategies that we all employ to ignore our own ignorance. That the Buddha understood that upon his awakening and gave us an Eightfold Path to recognize ignorance, to recognize deluded thinking. How would a deluded mind know that it's deluded? It wouldn't unless it had a way of looking at that mind clearly. Remember in the Nagara Sutta how the Buddha describes being stuck in this feedback loop until he understood reality and was able to extricate himself from that type of circular thinking that simply reinforces ignorance. That's another word for mindfulness. So that sixth sense of consciousness or fabrications is what is formed from ignorance, dependent origination. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes those fabrications. So thank you for bringing that up. Ultimately, what it is, what we're changing is this underlying thinking that is informed by the other five physical senses. That's how we are as human beings. But we can't really, that's such an obvious statement to me now. But if someone said that to me a few years ago, I think I probably would have just ignored it as nonsense, because it's almost too close to home to realize how important that is. But it's all rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and it's all abandoned by the Eightfold Path. And that's the only way. It's something that can't be seen clearly until you are quite removed from it. Maybe completely removed from it. Remember, the Buddha wandered around northern India for 6 years prior to his awakening, and he didn't quite get that last point of recognizing his own ignorance. It wasn't until his awakening that he was able to look back on that quality of mind, much like I just asked Frank to do, and realize the difference. Let me continue. Great questions tonight. Thank you. There being joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is serenity, there is contentment. The Dhamma is present moment by moment, and they dwell in mindfulness. When one dwells well restrained of thoughts, the mind is not agitated or distracted by ideological fabrications. There is joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Think about that when we get caught up in ideologies. Even if at that point, if we recognize that we're caught up in a point of view that is creating chaos in our lives or someone else's life, to practice restraint. That kind of goes to Frank's question. How do you do this when you're not part of the Sangha? Restraint is the answer, to be mindful of this. There being joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is serenity. At that moment of contact, no matter what's going on around us, if we're joyfully engaged in the Dhamma, our minds are at peace. We've developed a peaceful mind state in a less than peaceful situation. There is contentment. What a powerful word that is often overlooked in the Dhamma. We're content. It's another way of saying we're at peace with what's occurring. We're simply content with our life as our life unfolds. What a marvelous gift to give ourselves. Ongoing contentment. To stop craving and desiring and grasping. Whether it's an immediate change or things or that people need to be different or anything. I'm content. I'm content because I understand the way things are. They can't be any different than they are right now. Many people get caught up right at that point because there's so many things wrong in the world or perceived that way that we feel we must do something about it. But if that doing something takes us out of what's occurring right now, we've lost our minds. And again, it doesn't mean that we take important and skillful steps towards bettering the world around us. But we're in a much better position to do that if we do what the Buddha did before he tried to help anyone. He awakened first. It's always an interesting thing to me that the Buddha left, he was born an incredibly compassionate person. When you read the few things about him when he was a youth, you realize that that was part of who he was. And he was in a position as the prince in his father's kingdom to make pretty significant changes in the lives of people around him. And his father was a benevolent ruler too. But yet it wasn't enough for him because he knew, at least intuitively, that that wasn't nearly enough. That all he was doing was throwing a few drops on a raging fire, the world is aflame. He left that position of power to find a true answer to the nature of suffering. And that's what he developed. And maybe the difficult part of it's not something, we can't change the suffering in the world by decree or by legislation or by the right president or ruler or by the right ideology. We can only change the suffering in the world I can only change the suffering in the world if I change. And then as Frank described before, and then try to, as best, encourage other people to let go of all the anger and confusion and suffering. And how do we do it? The most effective way is by example. That's how the Buddha did it, by the way. The Buddha didn't take out ads. I guess there weren't any ads. But he didn't stand on street corners. There probably weren't many streets either. He didn't scream and holler and tell people, you better change, the end is coming. He lived this beautiful life as an example of profound mindfulness, and it attracted people to him. And those that wanted to learn and change did. And again, the most amazing thing to me in my lifetime is those teachings are still extant, they're still effective right here today. We just talked about that. Let me continue. There is contentment. The Dhamma is present moment by moment, and they dwell in mindfulness. The Dhamma is present moment by moment, and we get to dwell in mindfulness. This is how one dwells in mindfulness. It's the end of the sutta. Thank you. I could say this about every sutta, but there's some that I can't even say they affect me more than others, because they all affect me on some level. But what a beautiful sutta, isn't it? Really, what you can almost hear the urging of an awakened human being to wake up, to develop mindfulness. And it's not all that difficult. And I don't mean to say that it's not challenging at times. It's challenging for all of us at times. Sometimes you are laying in bed at night wondering what we're going to do with the world being aflamed. But what do? We come back to the Dhamma. We take refuge in that Dhamma, and we carry that refuge with us. As much as we develop it within us on our cushion and during our study and part of our Sangha, the more we can carry that refuge with us moment by moment in all areas of our life. So, what a great sutta. Any questions about the sutta? We'll go around the room. Lorna was here on Saturday, so and you might not have an answer for this question, but I'm really just curious. Did you see or hear something different tonight than you did Tuesday?
No.
What? I just left. What's that word? I can't. It left me hanging. Was it? Did you find it useful on Saturday? And was it useful tonight?
Well, I guess it's my turn to speak, so I'll speak it.
It is.
On Saturday and this evening, I find this sutta and suttas like this the most challenging to listen to and the most challenging to understand. Because to me, you can't push anything back out onto into phenomena. They're all about yourself, and they're all about your own thinking and your own misconceptions of life. And I sat through many, many, many evenings like tonight. And it's hard to listen to and accept and understand. Even though I know it's the truth, it's hard to accept it and understand it and really take it home. And I find these suttas sort of really more challenging. For instance, the fire sutta, you know, fire discourse. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can picture the scene of, and it's all sort of outside. You can sort of picture it. In this sutta, there's nothing to throw it back out onto for you to look at. It's all homework. And I find it the most challenging to understand. Well, not to understand, but to learn from and change. You know, because I just push it all back again, or I reject it, or something. I just, you know, that's all I can say. And it happened on Saturday.
Yeah.
If you remember on Saturday, I started talking. I said, "You're teaching the wrong sutta."
Yeah.
Remember? Because I just couldn't accept it. You know. And I said to you when I was speaking, I said, "You know, come in this morning. You seem to be teaching the wrong sutta, because." I just couldn't accept it. I was, my mind was on one thing, and you were teaching this, and it just wouldn't go in. And as I say, this is tonight. It's the same, because it's all so personal in my thinking that I just find it so difficult.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I can understand that and see that. There's not really. There, thinking about the sutta, there's no external context to it.
Exactly.
And maybe that is the essence of refined mindfulness, is I think the sutta teaches, points to that this really is about a mind well united with the body, And there really is no other reference for that. That is something that just has to be experienced. So I hope you find it useful in the way of pointing your mind in a certain direction, and maybe creating a creating a context for that refined mindfulness. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Glad you're here. Matt, good to see you tonight.
John, good to be here. Good to see everybody. I like what Lorna said, in that, and the sutta really goes that way, because it's talking about practicing restraint. Mm-hmm. So where do we practice restraint? In our own individual experience of reality, phenomena.
Yeah.
So when we are washed away, taken away by our own mental fabrications, when we're locked into our own view and experiencing incredible suffering because of it, you know, that's where this is the context. This is the context for Dhamma.
Yeah.
So I like that. I like the sutta. It's good to hear that, and in that we can't look anywhere else. We can't look outside for relief. We're the ones causing the problem, if there is a problem.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a problem, it's because we've been swept away by our own mental fabrications and have generated a view because of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
If we're experiencing intense agitation and roiling mind, it's because we have a view that we can't let go of, and or that we just haven't seen clearly yet. And when we do, then there's peace, there's calm, there's stability.
Yeah.
So it's cool that, you know, I like, Lorna, that you saw it's homework. It's homework, you know, and that the suttas live that way as homework assignments. For
yeah, it's a good way of putting it, yeah.
And that we, you know, it's only in our own minds that there is suffering.
Thank you. I need to come here more often. Thursday's class and Saturday's class will both be on restraint in a different way. So I think Thursday's the, I don't think, I know, it's the on the Aparahana Sutta, and Saturday's the Sundari Sutta. And they both speak to restraint in slightly different ways. So hope you'll be able to listen to them. I'll see you Saturday. Ram, good to see you tonight.
Mm. Good to be here. I was looking back just now over why I'm so glad that I found Dhamma here. And I realized how confusing my life was beforehand in a practice that just had some vague promises and you know, grand schemes of things, and here it comes back to what you do day to day, minute to minute, and everything you do and everything you think and every way you look at anything is part of that effort. You can't really take a break from it. And it makes it more satisfying to me to do this. It's, you know, it's not some of course I'll sit for my half hour in the morning. Here, but rest of life as it goes along, it just applies every time for everything, and you find yourself agitated about something, and it immediately points you back to, oh, what are we doing now? You know, where is, yeah. And a lot of times, where is my restraint here? You know, did I lose my restraint? Yep, I did.
Yeah, and what do you do at that point? You bring your mind back into the present.
Mm-hmm. How am I feeling now? What did I just do? Did I harm somebody? Thank you.
Mike, good to see you tonight.
Thanks, Sean. Enjoyed the talk very much. Good to be here, as always. Agitation is something near and dear to my heart. I was thinking about something recently. I volunteer at a music festival each year in Clinton. The couple who runs it, I'm good friends with. And last year, the woman of the couple said, thanked me at the end of it, and she said, "You're always such a calming influence." And I took that back home, and I told my wife and daughter, and they practically fell on the floor. And I'm only slightly exaggerating it. But it did make me think about how I act when I represent myself versus how I act when I represent others. So when I'm at this music festival and we get people coming up and they're complaining because they want to get in for half price because the show's half over, you know, it runs from noon to 11 p.m. and it's 6 o'clock, well, why should I have to pay full price? And if I were in charge, I would say, get lost. That, let's say old me. That's still the way my brain thinks. I don't know if I pulled the trigger on it, but when I'm representing them in the festival, I'm totally polite and courteous. And I said, well, you know, I'm really sorry. We can't let you in for less, because then everybody would come later on, want to see the main acts at the end. Mm. So I try to explain. So, and I've kind of realized I do that with work as well, because I have people I deal with at work who aggravate me to no end, but I'm representing my employer, and I'm also, well, that's also to keep my paycheck coming in, but it's just made me kind of think about how, you know, there's almost two personas, and how the persona that I use representing others is often a lot nicer than at least the one that's in my head. I won't pull the trigger on some of the things I think, whatever, but, and it's just, it's kind of made me see if there's a balance there or something.
Yeah. Wow. That's profound insight, Mike, just to see that within yourself and to understand that you're now engaged in a process to bring that all together and just be who you are all the time. You know, it's another way of saying, you know, being at peace, to be who we are. Acting in that other way is acting from a fabrication of who you think you are rather than who you really are. Good for you. And thank you for bringing that up. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Sangha, and you told us before that the Buddha stated and said that of the three jewels, the Sangha is the most important. So you can come here and hear a talk like this and bring it back and take it home to ourselves and apply it. And that really is why it's most important. But it is the Sangha and
thank you. You bring up something else that kind of alludes to what Lorna was talking about. Just hearing these words, these preserved words of the Buddha all these years later, has an effect, whether we realize it immediately or not, or even understand it. it gets into us. It's part of our Dhamma practice. We find usefulness out of these words when we don't even realize that we've taken it in. I think you'd say that too. It's just how it works. Thank you. Frank, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. Good to see everybody. Welcome back, Matt.
Thanks.
It's a Tuesday night anyway. Being at peace with a less than peaceful mind state seems to be a good theme for me lately and an ongoing thing. And when I'm practicing mindfulness and being mindful of how I'm feeling, really without like judgment, like judging that less than peaceful mind, I'm still not real happy about it, because I like to be peaceful and I don't really care to kind of acknowledge that external sources kind of can steal or disrupt my peace. But I think what's important for me to recognize is that how my behavior has changed, like my relationship to whatever's going on. So that's like practicing restraint. Is there a practicing restraint at the intellect or something?
Yes, yeah.
Is that at the intellect?
Yep.
So practicing restraint there is important for me because my behavior in the past has gotten me into trouble and has caused more damage, not only for people in my life, but even for me, like how I would then, like my relationship with myself. And then, so it really comes down to relationships with me and my behavior. So it's letting go of my reactivity, how I respond, how I react to something, whether it's a person, place, or a thing, and being able to let that go, and acknowledging that I have a less than peaceful mind, being okay, and then bringing it back to the body, the breath, and then before I know it, it's off, you know, it's off the chart, and I'm on to something else, and, you know, and I'm, I guess, feeling the cessation of whatever that suffering was. And I guess I'm seeing, like Matt said, how the Dhamma is like here. It's not out there. It's like here. It's going on inside.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's all I got.
Thank you, Frank. The reference you made to practicing restraint at the intellect, that's in here too. That's the that's the culmination of the Dhamma. Is to, we're so enamored with our thoughts. A mind rooted in ignorance is so enamored with its own thoughts that it will do anything to defend those thoughts. Another way of saying that is just because I have a thought, it's reality for me. And because I've now attached to it, I'm clinging to that thought, I'll defend that all the way to the end. And so the essence of the Dhamma is going from wrong views, clinging to wrong views, to letting go of those wrong views at the intellect and developing right view. Mm-hmm. So it comes down to our thinking, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And how we think about things, how we think about ourselves in relation to the world. And if those thoughts are framed by reality, by the Eightfold Path, we have a life of peace and happiness. Thank you. Liz, good to see you tonight. Thank you for the email earlier.
Pardon me?
Thank you for that email.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So I don't know if I can articulate this, but it's... So in order for us to do the work, the aligning ourselves with the Dhamma, we know that there are certain things we have to do to work towards this idea of an awareness or an enlightenment or whatever you want to call it.
Mm.
And then when we reach that ultimate level of we get to practice the Dhamma. So it's on both sides of the wall,
yeah,
that you're doing the same thing that you're going to end up doing if you reach that point. So I think that's, I can relate to what Lorna was saying is that, so you know that, and you go, damn, you know, I got to do this, and then I get there, and I have to do this, you know, and it's like, you know, it's the practicality of the whole thing, and it's just the way it is, and it's just what you have to do. So, you know, that old saying of chop wood, carry water, you know, it's like, you reach enlightenment, you still have to chop wood and carry water. You know, it's just the way it is. So,
yeah.
That's all I have.
That's great, thank you. Yeah, when you're done meditating, you meditate.
You meditate, you do it again.
I got a question from a student, and I never got the question before. I think I've said it here. This is probably a year and a half ago. He said, why did the Buddha keep meditating after he awakened? Think about the mind. He was meditating for one specific purpose. And so why would a Buddha do that? Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't any of us?
So when Frank was talking, you know, you talk about the chaos that exists outside you that you may or may be able to impact, but you have no control over and all of that. That never goes away. That's always going to be there. And it's the only thing you can do is decide how you're going to react to it.
Yes.
And, you know, and I think mental fabrications are one of the things that are the most destructive to reaching a better level of a better quality of life. You know, the things we construct in our own minds about
everything.
The end of days or whatever it is you construct in your mind. And so to counteract that, you sit and you meditate. So you sit and you meditate. You may still have mental fabrications, but then you just sit and meditate because that's the only way to get away from them. In essence.
Yeah, thank you. Well, and you're meditating to deepen your concentration so that your fabrications don't keep you so continually distracted that you can't develop the rest of the Eightfold Path.
Exactly.
You know, any fabrication is in essence a distraction that you've attached yourself to.
But it's the brutal realization that chaos exists.
Yeah.
And it's going to exist.
Always.
Always. Every day, no matter what.
For the purpose of the Dhamma, the First Noble Truth describes human life on this planet. In fact, you could say life in the universe, because, you know, the universe itself is a pretty violent place. Stars and planets and all kinds of stuff is always blowing up. Dukkha occurs. And it's going to occur no matter who or what I am, so I might as well be awakened in the midst of the world being on fire. Isn't it a much more pleasant place? It's really the only choice that I have. And in so doing, like Frank eloquently showed before, at least I can influence and hopefully encourage peace and equanimity in other people in the midst of a world that is prone to trucks running out of control and smashing into buildings. You know, nobody planned that. You know, there it is. It's part of the world. Thank you, Liz. Bonnie, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm good. There's nothing that I can top the chop wood, carry water.
Thank you. Thank you all. A few announcements. You'll notice in the email that there's a link to the newsletter archive. The reason why that's there, I put it in there a few times, but if you're using the app, that can be helpful to go directly there, and then you can read today's the week's emails. Mm-hmm. And that goes back about 10 weeks. It's two clicks to whatever that weekly email is, and it'll always be available 12:15 on Monday, 12:15 on Thursday. So if you want to just do that through the app, you can do that. And also if you wanted to reference, you know, last week's or 5 weeks ago talks, you can do it that way. We have a new Dana project. We are collecting Dana donations for the Raritan Learning Center's sign. They need a sign out front to help promote their business. So there's a basket out front that will fill up quickly. It's only going to be for a couple or 3 weeks, because then we're getting into our Dana dinner season, which will be Tuesday of Thanksgiving week, and there'll be a different the Donna basket after that. So those are the announcements. Our retreat is about 5 weeks in 2 days from today. If you're going to join us, all the men here are going on retreat.
Is it going to be an all-male retreat?
Almost. Oh, what's the woman's name that's coming?
Eileen.
Do you know Eileen?
What's that?
From
the
Chino?
Do I know Eileen?
Yeah, she's been, her and her sister come. Mary and Jane.
Yes.
There may be a few other women, but and I'm hoping that Eileen won't be the only one. But it doesn't, we don't really get into gender roles on retreat anyway. It shouldn't matter too much. All right, let's. Any questions or comments? All right, we'll finish with the Metta Sutta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditation posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. Again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.